This is Rusty Tanton.
And Amber Ray.
And you're listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network, the show that's better at getting interviews than coming up with these ad-libs. What you're about to hear is a recording of a panel discussion Amber and I participated in on September 2nd at DragonCon, which was part of the podcasting track. Its title was Interviews, Getting and Doing. Enjoy.
I just assembled a really great cast of interviewers for Interviews, Getting and Doing. How to get them, how to prepare meaningful questions, conduct and edit the off-rambling and disjointed audio into something good. These people all know how to do that. So if we could start off, introduce yourself and talk about your podcast.
I'm Paul Fisher. I'm with the Balticon podcast and the ADD cast. I interview scientists and authors and techies and artists and musicians at the Balticon science fiction convention, and then release the audio over the course of the year. So I do about between 30 and 50 hours of interviewing over 4 days. And I spend the rest of the year editing it within an inch of its life and releasing it. And when I get bored with all that, then I do some occasional interviews on the ADD podcast, the ADD cast.
My name is Fraser Kane, and I'm the webmaster of Universe Today, which is a space and astronomy news website. And so I do a podcast for that, where I interview astronauts and scientists, and you know, for breaking news. And then I've also done a few guest interviews for Skepticality while they were having a little downtime over the course of the last year or so.
My name is Stephen Ewan Cobb, and my show is called The Future and You, and the subject matter is the future. I interview people mostly, lately at least, it's been mostly science fiction writers with a mixture of scientists, and I hesitate to use the word ordinary people, but basically that's what they are, a small town mayor and other professional people, and for their opinion on what's coming in the future, trends within their own profession, or any kind of futuristic stuff that they can identify or predict or say something meaningful about.
My name's Amber Ray, and I'm the co-founder, along with Rusty, of Georgia Podcast Network, and we're a portal site that we have a lot of different podcasts, all locally focused, but Rusty and I do a show called Mostly ITP. If you're not from here, that means Inside the Perimeter, which is the cool place to be in Atlanta, and we just interview, I guess, mostly, you know, normal people, too, just people in Atlanta who are doing interesting and noteworthy things.
Uh-huh. I'll just echo that with Amber.
So where does it start? Do you have people who come to you when they see your show and say, I'd like to be on your show, would you interview me? Or is it more often that you have somebody you really want to talk to and you have to figure out how to make that connection with them?
For me, I normally go after the people that I want to interview. Other than T. Morris, I normally don't get people asking to be on my show until I get to Balticon. We're only in our second year. We just started our second year of Balticon, so we've only done two big recording sessions. So this year I did actually get a couple authors who wanted to be on the show and back on the show. But normally I'm running around trying to figure out who I want to interview, and I have to wait for, you know, all of the guest lists and things like that to be done. But I found that, by and large, people are very open to being interviewed if you handle it in a professional manner.
Yeah, for me, I don't know who I'm going to interview because I base it on the news that's breaking. So in many cases, there'll be a news release or some big piece of news, and then I'll have to start chasing and find out the person that I'm going to interview and get a hold of them within, you know, within a couple of days before the news starts to get a little stale. So so it's more like, and the problem is that when you're wanting to interview them, everybody else wants to interview them at the same time, so they're a little tired of it as well. So it's a little hard. With Skepticality, I just do as I'm told. So, you know, call this guy, all right. So, but yeah, it is definitely a bit, for me, you know, it's definitely a bit of a hunt and a chase to get a hold of them, corner them, find out a time when your schedule, their schedule works, you know, especially when, you know, they're in Australia or, you know, who knows where they are. So
my method is mostly I contact people to interview them. Maybe 10 or 15, 20% of the people ask me for them to be interviewed. But my method for getting interviews is I search online for people who I believe have some knowledge about the future, whether they're scientists or in the case of authors. And if I can get their email address, that's my favorite method of approaching them, because I have a wish list of topics that I would like people to talk about over a period of time that's very long. And I email them that at the bottom of the bottom of my email. And some people have said that they were actually intimidated by the list, but the list is simply suggested topics, and it covers everything from cryonics to cosmetics, I guess you could say, as far as the future goes. And that has really been a really effective method for getting interviews, so that they have a notion of, instead of having to make up something to talk about, they know, you know, a lot of different subjects that they kind of spark off of.
Something that's unique to podcasting versus other media is a lot of people aren't going to know what it is when you approach them with it, and you should have it in your head, a way to explain it to them in two sentences so that it's simple enough to understand and that you can get right to the meat of the topic. I have come to a point where I describe it as internet radio, even though that's not totally accurate, because it's just easier, they understand it, and it's close enough to accurate that it reflects that. So
sometimes when we ask, do you want to be interviewed for a podcast, they get very suspicious looking, and what is that? What is this going to be used for? But in terms of getting interviews, we usually approach people, usually via email, just people that we hear about in Atlanta locally that are doing things that we've heard of, and we usually just shoot them an email, and they're usually very receptive.
How often do you, or have you ever had guests with you in the place where you normally record, or do you almost always have to call the person or Skype the person? Do you ever get fortunate enough to do live interviews with you?
I've done a couple of live interviews in the studio at home. When I'm at Balticon, they give me a room that I get to transform into a studio, and I bring literally a Prius load of gear, kind of like what you see that Derek and Swoopy have brought, and we set up a studio, and we get people in and sit them down and interview them. But, you know, if I do follow-up interviews or any interviews for the ADD cast, it's either on the phone or over Skype. By quick show of hands, who knows what Skype is? Okay.
Excellent.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever done an interview in person.
Is that because you're Canadian?
I live in a small town on an island off the coast of Canada, so, you know, for me to actually get into some kind of studio. But I actually have a friend who works at the CBC, and so when I was first starting to do the podcast, that's the Canadian Broadcast Corporation, we do good radio, called him up and said, you know, like, how do you guys do these interviews? Because they sound so good. And, you know, you bring people in-house, you fly them up to Toronto, what goes on? He says, no. They have a studio there. We have a studio here. We connect our two places with an ISDN line. And then we just, you know, we record it live and patch it together. And it sounds like they're just in the same room. It's very intimate, very personal. They can't see each other. So, you know, I think if you get a lot of practice doing that, warm them up, then you can get by not having to go to all the work to get, you know, into the same room as the people that you're interviewing. So I haven't yet, you know, I don't have a Prius, so I can't really, you know, fill it up with all that stuff. So
most of my interviews are over the phone. Maybe 20 or 30% have been in person. Usually at cons, but not always, if they're a writer. But some of the other interviews I've done were kind of on the fly and unexpected, and I just happened to have my digital recorder with me and came across someone interesting. I was fortunate enough to get 20-some interviews last year here at DragonCon in the Walk of Fame. A buddy of mine has a magazine called Nth Degree Magazine. I don't know if you're familiar with it. And I asked him, well, you know, how about if I interview people and maybe I could write it up and put it in your magazine? He said, sure, go for it. So I had my little really cheap tape recorder, a micro cassette tape recorder. And I interviewed, Wednesday and Pugsley from the Addams Family, Aaron Gray, 22 different people in the Walk of Fame. And then later, I decided to do a podcast, and so I stuck one each of them in each episode, in addition to the other interviews I was doing. But other than those celebrities, most of them have been through Skype, which is the phone interview.
Most of ours are actually in person. I know because we're locally focused, so we like to talk to local folks. And also, I prefer to do in-person interviews because you get that eye contact, body language, you know, that you can't always get the same kind of thing out of phone interviews. We've done some phone interviews, but most of them are either people come to our little makeshift studio. We actually have monthly podcast parties where we have a bunch of people over, record lots of different podcasts all in one night. And then we also go out and just meet people places and do interviews with the digital recorder, come to things like Dragon Con and just walk up to people for short interviews.
Yeah, I would just echo I think it's much better when you can, and it's not always practical to interview people in person. People act differently in person than they do over the phone. They are a little less likely to put up an artificial front that is more of a sort of PR generated front, because if they have to look you in the eye and tell you something, it's a little different.
Good point.
So with all of these long-distance interviews that you do, do you all use Skype for these, or do any of you have a telephone hybrid or other technology that you've, you know, rigged up? How would somebody go about doing a quality phone interview or Skype interview?
I actually have your old telephone hybrid.
Didn't know that.
In the constant battle of Michael R. Menengay versus Paul's bank account, I started off with the telephone box, and I've recently transitioned most of it over to Skype, mostly because it sounds better. The audio quality you get through Skype is a lot better than what you get through a landline phone, which is in turn much better than what you get from a cell phone. And some of the people that I've interviewed only have cell phones and Skype. And given that choice, I'll take Skype.
Yeah, I'll do three things. One is I'll try and do a double ender if I can, which is where you get them to use their nice recording equipment and record their side of the conversation, and then you record your side of the conversation, and then you mash it together, and then it sounds like you're in the same room, which never happens. So then if they've got Skype, that's wonderful. But most of the time, you know, once again, I'm talking to scientists I'm talking to, you'd think would know about this stuff, but, you know, they have no idea what I'm talking about. So I'll call NASA, and, you know, they'll say, you know, can they use Skype? I'm like, what? And I tried a couple of times to try and explain it and get them to use it. No, it's a total waste of time. So then I've got two sound cards in the system, so I can record my side of the conversation, and I can also record their side of the conversation in Skype, calling them through the telephone system, which actually is pretty good. I'd say it's, you know, in my opinion, it's about as good as a telephone hybrid connection. Derek may disagree with me, but I think it's pretty good. And then I'll just, you know, and then I can just merge it afterwards.
Yeah, my favorite thing about Skype, of course, the sound quality is part of it, but when I'm recording it, I guess it's the same way when you're recording it, my voice is in one track, separate and standalone, and their voice is in a different track, completely standalone. So I can alter the volume on their voice or my voice without altering the other. I can completely edit them separately from me. If there's, you know, clicks or pops on their line, I can silence them or vice versa. And it gives you the flexibility. I've had people that talk really soft, and I needed to increase the volume entirely on their entire track without changing mine. And when I used to do that, when it was all in one channel before I got Skype, I would have to go and highlight their voice in the editor and increase the volume, then find another segment after I spoke of their voice and increase the volume. And I would have to go through the entire thing finding their statements and increasing their volume. And the Skype, by having separate channels, eliminates that. Speeds things up a good bit.
Skype is great if everybody involved has a microphone, and we use Skype sometimes. The thing to keep in mind about anything like that is that your sound quality is only going to be as good as your weakest link. You might get great voice on your end, but if they're speaking through a cell phone, which is often the case if they don't have a microphone and headset, then they're still going to have cell phone voice quality, and that's going to depend on the quality of their phone and the quality of their network, and it could be okay or it could be pretty low quality. So just it's not a cure-all, but it's a nice thing to have when you can get access to it.
Yeah, in the worst case, at least you sound good.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Rusty did one the other day, though, that for some reason his track, he was doing a Skype interview with three different people, I think.
And I think that one was two.
Okay, but. Well, three including you. And his voice track got messed up for some reason. And so through the magic of having different tracks, he went back through and just, like, re-recorded all the stuff that he was saying completely separately and put it all back together. And it sounds like, you know, it's all one conversation. Yeah. So I guess, you know, never trust.
Try to get it right the first time.
Yeah,
though,
no,
because
it's even better the second time.
It turned out
actually, it got rid of some of the ums and the
yeahs.
I will say, through Ingenuity, I did just that thing. I had a podcast that is in hiatus at this time, Project Podcast for the Project Music label, and I was doing interviews with bands, and my first one that I ever did was with three members of the same band that were all in different places. We did it over the phone, and they did a three-way conference call and then called me. And one of the people was standing outside, and so I could hear street traffic, and then somebody else's, you know, three-way calling is bad to begin with. And the quality of the interview and the different levels from all the different people, plus me, was absolutely horrendous. And so I did just that. I cut myself out, and then I thought it was a way to be more concise. I went back through, and I voiced my questions more succinctly than I did when I was talking to these people and I was excited. And I did it that way from then on. I would write the questions, I would conduct the interview, and always cut myself out and put myself back in at the end. It took twice as long, but I thought it was a lot of fun.
Plus, you also sounded more brilliant.
Yeah.
Concise equals brilliance.
Well, yeah, it sounded like I wasn't the fangirl I was when I was talking to these people on the phone. And I was saying, yeah, I really love you. And I took all that out, and I was very calm. And so tell me about, yeah, that worked too. But with our phone hybrid, the first time we used it, we got complaints from our listeners. And they said, you know, your phone sounds, it's obvious that that person's on the phone. Can't you fly them into your studio? And then we had to explain that no, we were a podcast and we had no money and we weren't flying anybody anywhere. So that's very interesting. So now that you've got the interviews and you're conducting these long distance interviews and things like that, how do you keep the interview fresh? How do you keep from doing that? If it's somebody like you really admire, and how do you keep from gushing? How do you try and sound like a professional interviewer? Is it hard to contain yourself sometimes, or?
It's totally impossible for me to contain myself. I go completely, utterly fanboy. It runs out after 5 or 10 minutes, and that's where my real interview questions start.
Yeah, I'll get the fanboy in me out sort of beforehand. While, you know, I tell them that I'm warming them up, but really I'm kind of chilling myself down. You know,
it's great.
Yeah.
That's a good
and
one.
Then you know, by the end of it, then I'll be ready and do it. But the other thing for me anyway is I actually don't talk very much when I do my interviews. So I think that the radio shows that I don't like are the ones where the person who's doing the interviews has a lot to say. It may be well said, but I really don't, you know, move on. I want to hear what the person you're talking to has to say. So for me, I'll just let them talk and talk and talk, and I'll even, like, they'll get to what sounds like a pause in the conversation. You know, I just won't say anything else, and there'll be a silence, and then they'll keep talking, and then some of that's the more interesting stuff. You know, when they're really digging down and really getting some details. So, you know, in some of my interviews, I may do. Because I do a transcript at the end of every interview, and maybe I'll get, like, be 20 minutes long, and I've literally, I've said six things, you know, the whole time, because what they've got to say is so great, you know.
That's my exact style.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I tell them in advance. I'm not going to ask you a question unless you completely stop talking. And just say as much as you want about whatever you're going to talk about, because I want your opinions. I tell them, the show's not about my opinions. Mm. It's about yours. I want to hear what you've got to say. And as long as it takes you to say it, keep talking. And so that's where you get your best stuff.
Yeah.
You just turn them loose and let them go.
I agree as well. I read something where it was like, don't be Charlie Rose. Is that what it said?
Don't be Charlie
Rose. Don't talk over people because, you hear this person, the same person on the podcast every time you listen. It's going to get old. I mean, come on. You want to hear the person that they've got on for the interview. In terms of, going all fangirl or whatever, I don't know. For some reason, I'm really good when I have to at, just psyching myself out and, playing it real cool. The interview that, for me, was just, completely, on the inside I was being completely orgasmic, but I tried not to show it. I interviewed Eric Meyer and Jeffrey Zeldman and Jason Santa Maria at an Event Apart, which you probably know is a geek web developer conference, and they were here in Atlanta earlier. And it went really well, it was very conversational and everything, but on the inside I was like, oh my god, these guys are my heroes, but somehow I managed to play it cool.
Just try to ask concise, open-ended questions that have long answers, as opposed to, when were you here last? What do you like about this place? Something like that. Just get something where you know you're going to get at least 4 or 5 sentences in an answer, rather than last year. And then that's it.
Or yes.
Yeah. Yes or no.
Well, that's a good point. How do you keep from repeating the same interview with just different people? How do you keep it fresh? How much research do you do, if you can, about the person you're about to interview to make it sound like your questions are going to be better than every other interview they've ever had?
I try to listen to some interviews of that the person has already done if I'm going to interview them, so I know it initially to take some different tacks and to kind of follow on from where the other interviewer left off. The other thing I do is I don't listen to people while they're talking. I kind of listen just enough to get a sense of where they're going, and mentally I'm planning a bunch of follow-on questions. And if it were a glowing billboard, as they keep talking, I keep knocking them out if they answer them, and coming up with new ones so that when they do wind down, I've got a follow-on question that's fresh based on what they're talking about.
Well, you're good.
Yeah, well, it's actually for Universe Today, it is actually pretty formulaic, because in many cases there's a breaking piece of news, and so tell me about what you've discovered, and then, and how did you do that, and if I need to get more background, then I will, and if I have to, and then I always want to know kind of what's next and what kinds of, because the scientific method and the way these guys do this kind of follows a very similar track. The story is very similar, so it is actually formulaic, and actually, I don't mind it being formulaic. The ones that are hard are actually the stuff with Skepticality, where it was, more interviewing a person that isn't breaking news, so I had to really dig into who they were. And I think the hardest one that I ever did was I interviewed Story Musgrave, who's an astronaut, been to space 5 times or something like that. He's the bald guy. Anyway, that's where you're, total frothing fanboy, and at the same time, it's not like he's had any breaking news. So you've got to both kind of, cover, 40 years of astronaut, in the space program, etc., while you're trying not to, keep your words coming out. So yeah, those are actually the harder ones. The news, if you're just reporting the news or trying to get to the bottom of a story, that's actually pretty, it almost writes itself.
I always read 2 or 3 versions of their biography online. Maybe if they've been to a con or whatever. There's always some biographies online about most of the people that I interview. And so I use that as the things that they are interested in, like if they have hobbies, certain passions. And I can determine that this is a question that they would know the trends that are developing now for the future. And so I use those as launching points. I always prepare questions in advance because I'll forget them. I will. also, I have a list of generic questions about the future, covering nanotechnology, biotech, just about everything you can think of, that if they run out of stuff to talk about, I will ask them questions, and I'll tell them, if you don't have an answer for this, don't worry about it. I'll cut it out of the interview. It won't show up in the show. We will go through the list and see what things you have an opinion about, and I'll use those as launching points for them. Sometimes I'll hit something, they'll talk for 10 minutes. Sometimes I'll get 30 seconds, but sometimes it's really good stuff, even if it's short. So that's my method of preparation.
What we try to do is apply anything and everything to as local an angle as possible, which we think makes a distinction between a lot of the other interviews people will do. People, if you take a musician, for example, and they're going to be interviewed by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, well, you're not going to hear a lot, generally at least, about how what they're doing rose up from the area around them, for example, or how it affects the area around them, how their time in the area has affected them. And we like most to focus on how what they're doing affects their local surroundings, which are also our local surroundings.
Yes, I agree.
Do you think that maybe you have an edge as a podcaster because you have the opportunity to give a more in-depth interview, and possibly because you're not big media, you know, you might be more trusted to not distort what somebody says or to not eliminate their best quotes or things like that? Do you find that maybe you have an edge that way, that people will be more open to you?
I really think that is the case. Most people, when they get interviewed, they might get 10 or 15 or 30 minutes, and that might get cut down to 30 seconds. Probably never goes on any longer than 4 or 5 minutes in major media. And there's no time to get any real information across in that amount of time. It all comes down to sound bites. And when you tell someone that you're going to give them 30 minutes of uninterrupted airtime on a podcast, they know what that means, because they've been pissed about it for a long time, that they can't get something like that to really develop a story and explain things. Certain things are hard, and it takes time to explain them, and these people know it. And if you can give them that amount of time, I'll give people an hour if they have something to say. I'll split it in half and give them 2 hours. Mm-hmm. They can't get that kind of time anywhere else.
Yeah, I have the same situation. Like I said, the people that I'm trying to talk to are very busy and really tightly booked up, you know. But everyone they're talking to for 3 minutes, or for, you know, NPR for 4 minutes. So when they talk to me, I take 12, 15 minutes and can really cover the concept. So, and in other cases, I you know, because it's fairly niche, you know, space and astronomy, I get people who sometimes aren't that busy and aren't being interviewed, and so they actually don't have a lot of experience being interviewed. And that's, in some cases, that's a much harder job, because you've got to draw them out and, you know, hack out the ums and ahs later. So,
The fact that we don't have to deal with sound bites gives us a huge advantage, I think, over other interviewers. I interviewed Spider Robinson for 2 hours and 4 minutes, sliced it into, I think, 6 parts, and included it in 6 different episodes, although I typically have 4 to 6 different people interviewed in a single episode. My show is... I'm wondering now if maybe my show is the longest podcast episode in existence. Is it really?
It is.
Okay. My last episode was 2 hours and 3 minutes. I uploaded it yesterday.
I feel so much better now.
Yeah, mine was 12 minutes.
Okay, but I typically run over an hour, anywhere from an hour to 2 hours. The fact that we have the ability to put out such long interviews, even if they're only 15 minutes, 30 minutes for one person, really lets those people speak their real mind, what they really feel, and in depth, and to a detail they can't get anywhere else. So it's a huge advantage for us. Yes.
As far as being more trusted than mainstream media, I think that's definitely the case. But for the interviews that we do, a lot of the people, I would even say most of the people that we interview, are not, you know, famous on any type of level. You know, they're not people who have been on NPR or have been interviewed by the mainstream media or anything like that. So what's funny is a lot of the people that we interview, I've noticed that, you know, like, they treat me like I'm the press. You know, they get all nervous and they're like, oh God, I don't know, what am I gonna say? You know, they act like I'm the I'm just a girl with a recorder, but, you know, they act like I'm all, you know, press and everything. And so it's kind of funny, but I just forgot what else I was going to say. Do you want to say anything?
I guess the note I would make is that I kind of view mainstream media, newspapers, TV outlets, etc., as if you get a corporate report, you get an executive summary at the front of it, and then you have the main report on the inside. And what podcasters have the opportunity to do is to be something in between the full report and the executive summary, something that's better than an executive summary, but maybe not the full report, which people aren't going to take the time to listen to. They're not going to take weeks or years to understand something, but we can give them a little more detail than the regular press does.
Have you ever had anybody refuse to answer a question that you asked them, or were insulted by a question that you asked them, and you weren't expecting that to happen?
Not that I can think of, no.
No, not really.
I've had people refuse to be interviewed, but not refuse a particular question.
No. We've had people who either just didn't know an answer to a question, or actually last night in the bar at the Hyatt, we were just doing random interviews with people who walked by, you know, and that episode is up now if you want to listen to it. But this one girl, like, you know, we stuck the recorder in her face and everybody had been playing along and having fun, and then suddenly she pretended like she was deaf mute and just she wouldn't talk, and that was weird to me. I don't know why, but
yeah, I don't recall any other interviews really besides that. Yeah. We've also had people not really refuse outright, but just not respond to us. Mm-hmm. But you're gonna get that anywhere.
You must have a story, Swoopy. No?
About people refusing to answer my questions? No, because I feel like there's a difference between, and I don't think anybody on this panel does, confrontational interviews where it's, you know, opposing views or, you know, point counterpoint, like I'm definitely this and I'm going to, you know, interview Pat Robertson and talk to him about my subject matter, because some people like to listen to people squabble and fight, and I think there's so much of that that...
Yeah, I hate that.
That's the difference between light and heat. Mm-hmm. If you want heat and no light, you can watch, you know, Fox News or, Rush Limbaugh, you know, CNN,
well, we
Crossfire.
Well,
they're off the air now.
We interviewed a crazy street preacher at Atlanta Pride. We interviewed a protester there, and, Rusty did that interview, and it wasn't confrontational, basically just let the guy hang himself, which I think was the better tactic to take.
We've been playing with that idea that I've been thinking about doing a little bit of video, and I was going to go to some local Christian bookstores and ask them about the science content that they happen to have, or what they provide as science content.
Are you going to have snark quotes when you say, hey, can I see the
No,
science
I mean, because I am generally interested in what they have for science content, but I know that most of our listeners, the answers that will be provided, assuming that they're truthful from their standpoint, are exactly what my listeners would want to hear, and they would be outraged at what these people consider the truth. Mm-hmm. And on the flip side, I would go to, you know, a learning bookstore and see what educators buy for science material. So that's the kind of thing. But as far as, like, confrontational, no, I don't think I've ever had anybody refuse to say or answer something.
Opposing opinion stuff, I try not to police too much the opinions that are on my show. And so I have people on the show that believe completely the opposite of one another. But I don't have them both on the same show. They're not, you know, face-to-face or talking even on the same phone line, so to speak. They're a different day. They're a separate interview. Recently, I interviewed John Ringo, who believes that global warming is a hoax. And I'm going to describe it the way he did. Is a scientific hoax put forth by the scientific community, and their goal is to get funding for their projects, and if they say that global warming is false, they can't get funding because the government and their universities will not fund that. And the other culprit he identifies is the media, who are looking for the next headline in a huge competition with one another, looking for the next, you know, big headline, which, of course, global warming is not happening, is not a headline. Global warming is happening, is a headline. Now, I don't buy into his logic, but it does make, internally consistent sense. On the other hand, I've also interviewed people who are very much believe in global warming, and so I've tried to present both of them in their own words, in their own explanations, without any interference from myself. So
I think that would be the best way to do it.
Yeah, that way I get better detail to the listeners, I think. Are we taking questions?
Oh, absolutely.
When you do interviews like that with one person that has one view and another person that has another view, do you ever feel like you have a problem with injecting your own opinion into the conversation?
If I differ with them, I try to hold back because I don't want to intimidate them. And because I'm going to present their information in the show as they present it, but I will ask them for clarification if there are things where I feel that they're, you know, stepping outside the the bounds of scientific reality, so that they will, not so much that they will hang themselves, but so that they can at least address the things that their skeptics would, you know, would attack them by.
Yeah, I mean, the people I interview are mostly scientists, and they've all been kind of raised in the kind of brutal, you know, world of science where questions and skepticism is all they know, right? You know, to get to their doctorate level, they've, you know, been in front of a panel of, you know, X number of people, you know, breaking down their theory into little pieces. So in many cases, you know, anything that I could ask them is, you know, nothing. They're ready for, you know, almost any challenges I can throw at them. You know, I'd have to go to school for 12 years to be able to, you know, to ask a zinger.
Well, that's another good question. When you're interviewing someone of a certain caliber or profession or someone who is very esteemed in their particular field, do you ever feel slightly inadequate or afraid that, you know, they're not going to find your questions challenging enough or interesting enough?
Never.
Well, it's the opposite for me. I used to write for a newspaper, and actually some of the best stories I wrote were when I knew absolutely nothing about what I was walking into, because I could approach it as someone who knew nothing about it, someone who might be interested in reading a general news article about something and learning a little bit about it and ask the same questions they did, which if I were a little more knowledgeable about it, then I might have trouble sitting in their shoes.
Yeah, and that way your listeners who may don't know that much, you're asking the questions they would ask.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's a very good point. Especially interviewing authors. Ever assume that you know or have read every word that they've ever written, feel like you don't know them well enough to be interviewing them? Have you ever gotten that kind of response?
I used to worry about that because I interview a lot of authors. Many of them are hesitant to state a question to you in a way that will make you admit that you haven't read their stuff, because they are a little worried about it too, even while you are. And so while I'm hesitant to say stuff in a way that it sounds like I've read everything or read their main things, and some of them I haven't read any of their stuff. I mean, I'm not kidding.
Well, you talked earlier about the best kinds of questions to ask and how to think of questions. I think that the best questions really are just the basic, open-ended, the ones that come from either I don't know anything about this person or I'm pretending that I don't know anything about this person, because then you start from scratch and can get all the information, just such a breadth of information. And so that's why, I mean, I guess you could say a lot of the questions that we ask are the same questions over and over, but because we interview so many different kinds of people, it ends up going in all different directions based on whoever we're interviewing.
I think most authors understand that there are well over 100,000 books published every year, and that not everyone is going to know who they are and have read everything that they've written, or even the latest thing that they've written, and they try to find out how much you know about them, but they're mostly shooting toward the people who don't know who they are, and trying to convince those people that, you know, to pick up their book.
I encourage authors to mention their books, especially if they can relate something in their, since many of them are science fiction writers, something that their notion of the future relates to things that they've written in their book, which gives them an extra opportunity to mention their book titles within, as the, in the context of talking about the future. So I encourage self-promotion as far as that goes.
But have you ever gotten comments from your listeners regarding, especially authors generally, that you're conducting interviews, but it's more about shilling the book? Like, they feel like they're being forced into listening to somebody's sales pitch for a certain movie or book or something?
No, not yet.
I don't let them. I won't run it if all they're doing is shilling a book. They can do that anywhere. If they're not willing to open up and talk about the process of writing or you know, how they got to where they are today, how they got started, advice for people who are getting started, anything that someone might be interested in, then I'll just can it.
I've never run into that problem. Everybody that I've talked to had legitimate opinions about the future. They might not have been able to back them up, but at least they had opinions about the future. And so they were willing to talk about it.
I had one small press author who saw this as a beautiful opportunity to do nothing but
a commercial
for their book.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of felt dirty afterward. And that interview is backed up to DVD, mm-hmm. and that's where it's going to stay.
Mm-hmm. Well, it might be because people who go on these, like, media and press junkets, and that's what they're there to do. You know, they go on the tour, and they have to push it. And I wonder if it's almost unnatural to be in a situation where you want someone to be genuine and not just selling themselves.
I think the people that go on those tours are the larger authors, not the smaller authors, and most of them know the difference between, you know, meeting someone from the Washington Post who is a book reviewer who covers everything, to meeting someone who is at a science fiction convention who is asking them a lot of different questions that aren't about this specific new book, that they catch on to what, you know, what we're aiming at.
Have you ever had someone you've interviewed write back to tell you that something you talked about during your interview helped them out in some way, that it sold more books for them, or they got a lot of feedback about it from other people that they didn't expect because it was a podcast?
When I meet people in person, they tell me that you know, that they heard the interview, and they've heard other people who had heard the interview, and they thank me for it. But I don't get a lot of email.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't seem to get a lot of email either.
Yeah.
I think I get about, like I said, about 10,000 to 15,000 downloads of a show, and very few emails from people. Mm-hmm. Except, you know, do more. You know, what's the delay? But
we get people on blogs linking to them, like, you know, that they saw, they listened to the interview and thought it was good and linked to it, is what we tend to get a lot more of than emails.
I have to say that actually that happens to us quite a lot, that people that we've had on the show. Big example is George Rabb, who is actually here at DragonCon, and he came because of the podcasting panel and to see us. But he's a musician, and he has several CDs, and it was the only musical interview we ever did, and played clips of his stuff. And right after that, he had a lot of success with sales and spiking and things like that, and he really had embraced, especially I think it happens more in music, they realize that the opportunity the podcast provides them to, even though it's a free show or type of a thing, that in the end it is more rewarding to them. And I think that's really exciting.
The feedback as far as good results for people that I've, what little I've heard, has been mostly that it opened up new opportunities to them. It was like a networking thing, not so much that they saw, I've never heard anybody say they saw a sales spike, but I have heard people say, oh, I got an interview in So-So Magazine because I was on your podcast. Or somebody heard me, you know, on your podcast, and then they contacted me to write a book. I've heard that. So I've heard a number of different things, but they always seem to be networking things. Yeah, opening up new opportunities for people.
Well, or if you were the first podcast interview they happened to do, mm-hmm. they then realize and go to do other podcasts after that?
Maybe that too, yeah. But mostly it's been mixed media, yeah.
So interview that you really want to get that you haven't gotten yet. Who's your wish list?
Stephen King.
Good luck.
Thank you. Have fun with that.
Actually, I sent an email to Arthur C. Clarke in Sri Lanka, and I got an email back. He must have been interested because I got an email back from his agent, Russell Galen, who said, I can't quote it exactly, it was about two paragraphs long. It said, my client, Sir Arthur C. Clarke, I'd forgotten that it was Sir. I forgot he'd been knighted. My client, Sir Arthur C. Clarke, is interested in the possibility of being interviewed on your show. And could you send me some more information about your show so that I could determine if it's something he should do? And he said, you realize that he's 83 years old or something like that, and he wouldn't be able to do a very long interview, no more than 5 minutes or so. And, of course, I wouldn't care if it was 5 seconds if I had him on the show. But I wrote back and told him a little about the show and stuff and never heard another peep. So Russell Galen apparently put the kibosh on that. But there's a lot of people that would be great to interview. I mean, everybody's got their wish list, and it's probably not one person. But you just keep trying, you know, you keep trying with different people, and you hit on stuff. Yeah. But he'd be one of my top ones. Isaac Asimov's dead, by the way, so he's not available.
Yeah, there's almost too many to list for me. There's so many astronauts and scientists, you know. Maybe interview Stephen Hawking. If I can't get him, I'll just fake it, you know. But, you know, I've talked to three astronauts now, and that's just been amazing. So it's, I feel like I've already gotten there. So anything else now is just gravy.
What are the astronauts? Which astronauts do you think?
Rusty Schwartz, James Liu, and Story Musgrave so far.
Okay.
Yeah.
My list is far too long. Steve Jobs. George W. Bush. George H. Bush. Bill Clinton. Dick Cheney, who I actually met.
From under
his desk, yes.
Wait a minute.
Okay,
no, I was there.
Tell this story.
Okay. I was working for a small computer, actually a very large computer reseller in Maryland, and we won a contract to deliver a whole bunch of Unix-based desktop computers to the Pentagon. This is 15, 16 years ago. So, you know, top of the line 386 machines.
Oh, 386.
At about $4,000 a piece plus Pentagon markup.
Oh, yeah, at least. Almost got shot bringing the equipment in. But I had to go through, and I was checking machines, and they were mostly put underneath people's desks, and it was, you know, had 97 things hooked up to the back of them. So to check this particular machine, which happened to be Dick Cheney's, it was under his desk, and I went under his desk and took the machine apart, and I had my flashlight in my mouth, and a screwdriver in hand, and I'm looking at stuff, and I hear people come into the room and start talking, and I'm like half paying attention, and I figured they know I'm there because everyone sees, you know, all the work that we have to do to let people know we're coming. They ought to know that we're there. And I went to college in Utica, New York, and my first job was in Rome, which is the next town over, at Griffiths Air Force Base. And Cheney was talking about base closings. And they weren't naming names, but they went down a checklist of a bunch of things, and the last two were the photonics lab and the only East Coast alternate landing site for the space shuttle, which is Griffiths Air Force Base. And they agreed to close it. They said, yeah, we can get rid of that one, at which point all pretext of actually getting any work done disappeared, and I popped up from under the desk and said, you can't close Griffiths. That's the only actually, they left out the shuttle. They left out the space shuttle. They mentioned the photonics lab. That's what did it for me. I said, you can't close Griffiths Air Force Base. It's the only alternate East Coast landing site for the shuttle. and Dick Cheney and two generals and another guy are standing there looking at me. And they're looking at me. Uh-huh. And I slink back down under the desk, and I close the cover on the PC. And you know, and they're still not saying anything. I was there for about 5 more minutes, and they didn't say another word. And then I left the room. And
deciding if they had to kill you or not.
I don't know, but they did not close Griffiths Air Force Base in that round of closings.
There you go. Nicely done.
Excellent. Yeah, very good. I bought Griffiths like another 15 months of life.
I think it's a good time to open it up for questions. If you have a question, you can raise your hand and we'll take the microphone to you.
Go on the back.
You touched a couple times on warm-up and talking to them a little bit before the show, some of the things that you talked to them about, and could you talk a little bit about some of that? And also, when do you turn the recording on? Do you do it even before it starts, or do you do it after you've been talking to them for a while?
No, I tell them, you know, it's off, and I tell them when I'm going to start recording, and they say, okay, I'm recording now, and I ask them to talk, and then make sure that I'm getting both sounds of it, and then I tell them that, you know, at the end I'll say goodbye, but then I'll stop recording, and then we can keep talking if you want. So no, I'll always make it perfectly clear when it is and isn't being recorded. With the warm-up, a lot of it is, you know, it's almost like you have to deprogram them a bit, because in most cases they're so used to sound bites, you know, they've got their elevator speech they've got to be able to give that includes, you know, very basic pieces of information like spaces when you look up and, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, I'll set the stage and say, here's what people will probably know. And, you know, they'll understand these terms and this kind of stuff that's relating to the research that you're doing. They're like, oh, great, I don't have to explain that again. And then, you know, I'll you know, talk to them a bit about what really kind of interests me in the story itself, which gives them an idea of sort of who they're talking to. But then, you know, that's kind of it. You know, maybe it's like 5 minutes before we start, and I'll also explain that, yeah, I'm going to let you talk and talk and talk. You know.
Yeah, my warm-up is whatever it is I think that they're most passionate about, which is usually, if it's an author, it's their books. And so they're so used to talking about their books that they can just rattle on a little bit about that, and that way they sort of settle in and they feel more comfortable about, you know, about the talking process. And I record everything, because it's usually a phone conversation, and all the little trivialities of, hi, how you doing, and stuff like that, I cut that out. And at the end, I usually ask them a little advice, like, for insider stuff on what's going on in the industry, like who to submit manuscripts to or whatever, any advice I can, you know, give them. Or ask them for another contact. Who do you think I should interview? Who do you admire their opinion about the future? And I've gotten a lot of good. That's where I got Arthur C. Clarke's email address. sometimes I get a lot. Sometimes I don't get very much. But the key for that is that at least if you fish a little bit, you might find something. And but again, I tape it all the way to the very end and slice it up as needed.
I try to start recording as early as possible, because I've had too many times where things have happened where, you know, we're just sitting down, we're talking, getting to know each other, and all of a sudden I think, crap, this is really good stuff that's going on right now. And once I turn the recorder on, you know, then they, you know, they act like, ooh, you know, because they're intimidated the recorder is on, you know. So sometimes now I'll just stop and I'll be like, wait, let's save this for the actual podcast.
I try to start recording as early as possible. I always let people know that I am recording and that I'm going to edit out anything that's going to make them sound stupid. I go through and remove a lot of ums and uhs of mostly of my guests, but only occasionally of me, because I'm allowed to sound stupid. But to warm the person up, a lot of times what I like to do is put them under a little bit of stress and get them out of their normal mindset for a normal interview. And the way I do that is I introduce them with what is normally their 30-second soundbite. So I'll introduce an author and I'll give their pedigree of books and explain a little bit about what the books are about, which, you know, that's the first thing that they're going to have in their head, and it's just evaporated. So now that the mind actually has to start working and the juices have to start flowing in order for them to you know, have a follow-on and answer to that question, and that makes the whole interview process better because it gets them thinking earlier.
Guys, do any kind of disclaimer or like get them to sign a waiver or anything like that?
No.
Yes.
What all do you include in that?
I have one that I cribbed from somebody who cribbed it from several other sources, and it basically says I am not responsible for anything. I am not responsible if you get on my podcast. I am not responsible if you don't. I am not responsible for anything I say. I am not responsible for anything you say. I am not responsible for the way anybody would take this. You know, it's just basically you agreed to stand in front of the mic and talk. And that's if you have a problem with that later, come talk to me. I'm a very reasonable person. Mm-hmm. But... Don't show up with the armed guards and the lawyers because that's the fastest way to get to have somebody shooting back at you.
For those of you that don't, do you ever worry about any possible repercussions if something were to happen?
My method, and I don't know if I'm unique in this, but my method is I'm willing to make them look good to get their ideas out there. My goal is their ideas. I want to hear what they really believe about the future, even if it's a little controversial. And when I edit, I slice out all their ums and ahs, if they stammer, if they repeat, I try to make them sound just as brilliant as I can make them sound, so that way they'll be comfortable, especially in the future if I interview them again. And also, if they listen to the show, they hear, like, Peter Stampfel, he's an editor at DAW, he stutters really bad, and he's got more ums and uhs than words, and I slice all that stuff. He sounds brilliant. And so, I mean, it sounds like a salesman, or something. So since my goal is their ideas, I'm willing to make them look as beautiful as you know, possible. So I don't worry about it at all.
I hadn't thought about it, but now I'm thinking maybe that's a good idea. I don't know.
Well, the downside on that is people were talking about their editing time. I have a 14-to-1 ratio on for every hour I have of my show.
Yeah, we don't have much editing.
I do a lot of editing. I do a lot of preparation for the interviews. I'm counting the interview time too, though, and mm-hmm. the writing questions for the interview. But I've calculated it several times, and it's approximately a 14-to-1 ratio.
Ours is more like 1.5-to-1.
Yeah. I thought 5-to-1 was bad.
Yeah, I'm about 5-to-1 as well.
Yeah.
Maybe 6-to-1.
Also, that's why while my show is long, I only do one episode a month. Yeah. I used to do one every 2 weeks, but it was killing me. Yeah.
Do you present the edited version to the interviewees to show them how it came out?
I've offered to. Nobody ever cared to hear it. No. Listen when the show's out.
I did it once. Like, one time, I contacted the... early on, and I told the person I was interviewing, like, you know, once it's done and I've got a transcript up, so I'll let you know, and then you can take a look at it and make sure I didn't get anything wrong, you know. And he was like, okay, and then he gets back to me. He's like, okay, now I got to put this in front of my management, and they've got to review it, and legal's got to look at it. And it was, you know, it was like 2 weeks before I could even use the interview that I'd done. And I just said, forget it. I'm never, you know, it's, you know, by the way, it's up. Go take a look at it, at, you know, at the moment that everybody else is taking a look at it. But if you give them a chance to get involved in your publishing process, then, you know, you've totally lost control.
One thing I do is that when the show's up, I email everybody that's in it to let them know, hey, your show's up.
Yeah, that's what I do.
That's all we do.
We'll go back and make corrections after the fact, but absolutely don't give them any sort of power to try to edit it beforehand, because that can become a nightmare very quickly. That happened to me one time exactly when I was writing for the newspaper, and it was 20 phone calls before it was done, and I resolved never to do that again. I would rather scrap the whole interview.
Most people won't expect it anyway.
Yeah.
Because
mm-hmm.
traditional media doesn't do it.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't worry about it.
Well, I would say a different side of that, though, is that if you happen to do a podcast for someone else or someone else's company, they will likely impose to edit what you do. And I experienced that a lot when I was working with the music label. And if somebody said something or referenced something and the owner of the label didn't like it, you know, he always had to listen to everything I did before I published it. So oftentimes I would find myself having done everything and completed a really nifty show only to come back and hear, well, you pronounced so-and-so's name wrong, so you have to re-record that. Or, you know, we'd rather that we didn't say that, so you need to cut that out. And so that's the nice part about podcasting for yourself versus podcasting for someone else, because, yeah, you do have, that's your content, and unfortunately, if it's somebody else's, then you're going to have to make some adjustments.
Yeah.
I'm curious, the question earlier about when you actually start recording, one of the, and maybe this is a little more technical, on the technical side of things, but I've always been told that you should start recording and record sort of dead air for a few minutes so that, or, you know, get some recording of the background noise so that you can cut out, like, you know, we don't really hear it, but there is a background noise of the air conditioning going on. Mm-hmm. So do you do that where you just record the dead space and then you turn the recorder off and then you do your warm up and then you turn it back on?
It is a feature that's offered in Audacity.
Audacity, yeah.
But and I've tried using it, but
it's worthless.
It's worthless.
Yeah. Actually, this noise in the background.
It sounds like a whirlwind.
Actually,
or something.
If you have Sound Soap, which is a wonderful package that only costs $100, it needs about 3 to 5 seconds to figure out what ambient is and auto learn it.
It actually works.
And it works very, very well. And you typically have to tweak it. It's got a couple of knobs, and you listen and you tweak the knobs and filter it. But it will get rid of massive amounts of background noise.
And where would you get this?
Bias Incorporated.
Downloadable?
Makes, I don't know. Is it?
I think so.
I bought it off Amazon or something for
Sound Soap.
Sound Soap. Yeah, it's between $80 and $100. Sound Soap 2, and for those of you with Macintoshes, it's not Intel ready yet. They promised it for the first quarter of this year. Second quarter. They promised everything they make for second quarter, but it's not out yet. I'm trying to find out now if it'll work on the Intel Macs at all. It probably will. But great package. Really, really great. There's a gentleman in the back who had a question.
I'm going to introduce a little negativity here. Just to clean it all up. Yeah, I know. But frankly, we're in a room full of people who think podcasting is the greatest thing since sliced bread, and I'm kind of one of them, and so therefore it's my job to tell you it's not. In the big scheme of things, the rest of the world doesn't know how cool podcasting is. It doesn't know that it's Swoopy and Derek, who are friends of mine, that can't fly people into their studios. They don't understand a lot of the technical aspects of podcasting in the big scheme of things. So when you say things like, I'm going to re-record my track, I go, are you kidding me? I mean, it makes you say, I'm going to change this interview to make you sound smarter. I understand that from the technical perspective. I understand it from why you'd want to do it. I also understand that from my political views and my followings of things, that leads you into a place where you might one day become more legitimized, and one day you might just change things a little bit too much, and then you're turned into regular media, the thing we're really trying to avoid being. Do you find, because it really only applies to interviews, when you're spouting your own views, you say what you want and re-record it all you want to, but when you're talking to someone else, do you feel like the possibility exists that in the future, when podcasting becomes even more legitimized, that this will become more of a problem, or that it will stay the sort of we're all in, on the same team?
It may already be a problem we don't know.
I guess that's where my whole point
that's
was.
That's why we try not to do a lot
understand?
Of editing, because I think that, I mean, I'll edit out if somebody just stays quiet for like a minute trying to think of an answer. Maybe I'll edit out some ums if they're excessive. But I don't like to do a whole lot of editing because I want the interview to be, I like them to be conversational, the whole thing. I mean, we don't do interviews that last a really long time. We try to keep it like 20, 30 minutes at the most, but I don't like to do editing because you don't get that kind of like just the
sincerity.
Real deal from most places, so we really just
do
minimal editing.
One of the biggest benefits of the minute.
And we think that's the benefit of podcasting, in fact.
Well, the editing I do is never for information. It's only for beauty. I have had interviews with people that there were segments that I didn't include, but it was a different topic because I could tell they were talking through the hat and they had no knowledge of it. It was, you know, I interviewed, I won't say who it was, except that it was a college professor, had some brilliant stuff to say about several different topics, and then I asked them, how do you believe that the United States will end? I mean, Rome ended, every civilization ends, every nation ends eventually. How do you think the United States will end? And he said, well, I think it's ending now. His notion was simply that because of George Bush and stuff like that, the United States is ending now. We are in the actual process of our civilization of falling, which was, and his other stuff he said that was related to that was so out in left field that, and this may sound silly, maybe it sounds excessive even, I was afraid he'd look like a moron if I included that. It wouldn't have been in the same episode as the other stuff. But his other stuff was clearly valuable, and because he could cite precedent and, you know, examples, and it was concrete, it was the stuff that I wanted. And so he's been in several episodes. But the other stuff...
Well, then aren't you kind of spinning at that point? I mean...
Well, I ask for multiple topics, and I tell them in advance that I'm going to include your topics, one topic in each episode, and then you'll be in several episodes. So if you talk about astronomy in one, and you talk about developments in nanotechnology in another, well then
yeah, but I mean, you cut out, you didn't want to use his thing that he said because
his political
you thought it
stuff.
Was. So I mean, aren't you? I mean, I would say let the listeners decide if he sounds crazy. I mean, he said it. Mm-hmm. Let the listeners hear it. That's my opinion.
Well, I only include about 10 or 15 minutes of each person in each show, mm-hmm. and the interview was already an hour and a half, mm-hmm. and so I was going to have to cut some stuff. So you do get into a really complicated area of what to include and what not to include, and I have kind of agonized over it sometimes. But frankly, I mean, while anybody you interview is going to have really good opinions about, or valuable, useful, meaningful opinions about certain topics, there's going to be some stuff where they have opinions that that really don't make any sense.
Well, I think we're out on the fringe right now, so we don't really even have to necessarily worry about those kinds of problems. And, you know, I don't think that there's anything new ground being broken in podcasting in the fact that, except that a person can subscribe to my shows. You know, 5-10 years down the road, it's going to go mainstream. People are going to sell out. There's going to be advertisers pressuring you to edit your podcasts and make them, you know, make their guests sound better and so on. I think there's always, but the nice thing this time around is that if I don't want to, then I can go and get my computer and hook up a mic and call someone and talk to them. And I've got a distribution network that exists. So I don't at any point have to, if I don't want to, step up to all those gatekeepers that each time will lay pressure on me to say what I can and can't do. But at the same time, I can absolutely sell out and, you know, let NASA pay my salary, and I'll, you know, say whatever they want. I'm not saying they've offered that, but, you know, if they made the offer. And so I think that, you know, that's going to happen. I think, you know, your concerns are totally justified, and, you know, just you wait for it. It'll all, you know, we'll get as corrupt as every other media out there. So
We hope. Well,
now, me first.
We live in a cut and paste society. I can take audio from some other source and cut it up and put and inject myself into that situation. I can take audio that I've recorded and I can reverse words, and believe me, you will not know I did it if I spend just a little bit of time doing it and completely change the meaning. It comes down to whether or not you are going to trust me. If I tell you I don't edit for content, but I edit for listenability, and you catch me at it, that's a big problem for me. And right now we're at the phase where there are enough people listening to know when someone is playing games like that. Rob Walsh from Podcast 411 did an amazing satire interview with Senator Stevens. The whole, the internet is made of tubes or pipes or whatever he was saying.
Tubes.
Series of tubes. It's not a dump truck. Exactly. And he, it was clearly satire. It was quite possibly one of the funniest things that I've ever heard, and if I were standing upright, I would have fallen over. And some of the people that responded to him for the way that he did this and the accusations that they made were way over the top as far as I was concerned, because it was clearly satire. You know, Rob came in clear, like he's sitting in front of the mic, and the stuff from Senator Stevens was, you know, all content that was recorded on the Senate floor and sounded really noisy, and it was funny. And anyone who didn't get that basically is too far ingrained in politics to remember what humor is. And you've always got that ability to do it, and the audience has got to keep people, has got to keep the podcasters as well as the bigger media honest. The problem that I find with the bigger media is typically you don't get enough information. They don't answer enough real questions in any depth for you to know whether or not, you know, what they're presenting is the truth.
Well, I should say, though, that when I edit, I say I edit for beauty. I don't mean that I edit, slice out some of their sentences or some of their phrases, just the ums and uhs. And if they, some people will start a sentence and then start the same sentence again. And so I'll slice up if they have those extra words at the beginning of their sentence, but it's still the same sentence. Also, I have gotten interviews with people who would not be willing to be interviewed if I had not told them, I'm going to slice out your ums and ahs. Peter Stanfell is the example that springs to mind, but I can think of several other people that were very intimidated about the idea of being interviewed because they know they sound awful when they're recorded. And so they were willing to go on the show because they knew that I did that.
I'd like to rebut all of that by saying that I believe that everybody in this room accepts the sort of genuineness associated with podcasting, and that it's your charge to keep that across time.
It's a responsibility, and we're all
responsibility as a citizen of, well, of as a human being, I think, at certain levels, to retain the genuineness associated with that.
And we all understand that there's a value to what we're doing, or we think there is, we're serious about that value, and we don't want to corrupt that value.
But I think there's a lot of people out there who want to make this their full-time job, you know? And, in you know, someone has to pay the bills to make it your full-time job. So if you have a regular job and you can do this on the side, then, and as I said, the wonderful thing is there are no gatekeepers. So if you want, you can be fully legitimate and have a million listeners to your show, and it pretty much doesn't cost you more than, you know, $10 on Libsyn, and that's it, and you reach as wide an audience as you like, but no one's going to pay you. You're not necessarily going to pay the bills. You know, you might, if you're getting donations, then someone's paying the bills. So, and that could be a corrupting influence as well. So, I think that, you know, for the people who need to pay the bills, there's going to be pressure, and you know, whether they continue on or not. I think, but never before in history have we had a chance that you could do it and do it for and get past all those gatekeepers. So I think, you know, I don't know whether it'll remain pure or not, but at least it has the opportunity to that no media before it has.
Real briefly, because we're over time, and we need to let people get to the other panel. So.
I just wanted to address that last thing you said, and because a lot of our podcasts are in kind of a niche element, there is a level where if you go and change something that somebody said, if you do it to the extent where it's literally changing what they're said, they're going to let somebody know. Yeah. And just like the New York Times, you know, if you make up a story in the New York Times, somebody's going to find out, you're going to lose reliability, you're going to lose your job. Well, it's the same deal with podcasts. If you mess up, well, the next person may say, hey, weren't you the guy that edited that other podcast badly? I'm not going to do an interview with you, or and you're listening listeners may say, well, I don't think what you did is right. You'll lose listeners. So it's still going to be the same thing. You still have that responsibility to the person you interview, the next person you interview, and your fans.
And in a sense, we're all kind of reputation building as we work on our podcast.
Yeah, reference Cory Doctorow and the concept of woofy.
And with that, I'd like to thank all of our panelists. We could go on and on because this was absolutely fabulous. But we have people here in 15 more minutes. We're going to have Voyage of the Dragonhearth live with Tracy and Laura Hickman. So let's thank all of our interviewers. I learned a lot.
Thank you.
I really did. I learned some really cool tricks from you guys. That's fantastic. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Mostly ITP on the Georgia Podcast Network. Visit us at gapodcastnetwork.com. If you know a Georgia band or a hippie with a guitar who would like to have their music featured in a podcast, have them contact us by emailing info@gapodcastnetwork.com or calling 678-389-9441. This way, the ending of the shows won't seem so abrupt.